diodes on the printed circuit boards, letting you know are all the voltages there. The first thing to do is to make sure you've got all the right voltages. In my particular case, a 1 microfarad tantalum capacitor, 1 microfarad, 35 volt, became a dead short circuit. And to find the particular one was a bit of a grief problem. I had to do troubleshooting by way of a voltage drop. In other words, by using a digital voltmeter in the millivolt mode, I literally was looking for who, on the schematic diagram, I found 40 different places where the short circuit could have been. By using a digital voltmeter in the millivolt mode, as I got closer and closer to the short circuit, I was looking through less and less copper strips of the microstrip printed circuit board, and I was seeing lower and lower voltages in the millivolt mode, and I eventually find the exact capacitor that was a short circuit and replaced it. What a number of people have done is to realize that after 20 years of service, for some reason those 1 microfarad and 5 microfarad, but mostly the 1 microfarad 35 volt tantalum capacitors, only being used at 15 or 20 volts, way below their voltage rating, for some crazy reason they develop whiskers inside and become a dead short circuit, and it drives circuits crazy. So even though the power supply, in your case, make sure that every one of the voltages is right, the next thing to do, I guess, is to make sure right at the counter itself, there may be some other intermediate voltage regulators to make sure the counter is getting a really clean voltage and clean reference voltage, which I think is 6 volts, but I'm not sure. The next level of troubleshooting is to be sure the counter is getting the exact voltages. After that, I don't have any great suggestions, but there is an online file you can go to which gives you the complete service manual for that whole series of signal generators. I wonder if you have that online service manual, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Dick, as I said at the beginning of my question, all the power supply voltages are correct. They only require very slight adjustments to each voltage. There's minus 21, plus 5.2, and plus 21. They're all right on the money, pretty much where they belong, where they're supposed to be. I have an HP paper copy service manual of this device. Yes, I can use the same service manual and spend hours to try to troubleshoot the problem. I just wanted to ask you, since you already own the instrument, has this ever happened to you, or you may be... you are familiar and you've heard this kind of problem happen elsewhere with somebody else?
Yeah, Bob recognized. Of the failure that I had, I didn't have that exact failure of the counter, so I don't have experience with that one. However, Bob in California, in Florida, owns that signal generator, and maybe he's running into that problem. Let's see what Bob is suggesting. K4NBC, K2RIW. You got it, Bob.
All right, Dick, K2RIW from K4NBC. Actually, I'm lucky. I have a good one. Never given me any trouble. I did buy it off of eBay several years back, along with a HP, can't see the number on it here, 8559A 21 gig spectrum analyzer in the 182 frame. However, I did have problems with those tantalums in my Tektronix 7L12 plug-in. And, yeah, those things are really, can be real difficult, you know, to dig out and isolate. And you don't want to cut traces on circuit boards to isolate legs. One way of finding it is to run high current at the rated voltage and you know, pop it like a pimple. Although I don't approve of that way of troubleshooting, but when I had this problem and I saw that voltages were being dragged down, and you know, and they, these things have these power supplies, you can't, you know, short circuit. I just had to start lifting them one leg at a time and measuring them with an ohmmeter until, you know, I came up with the perpetrator there. So, and I also did it without a service manual. But
the...
I can help them, Dick.
Yeah, we got both Eric and Mel in that order. And Bob did turn time out the machine. But right now, I think there's a 50-50 chance your failure is going to be those 1 microfarad tantalum, little bitty tubular, silver-looking, axial lead capacitors. They give a lot of grief with Hewlett-Packard equipment. A good brand name, but for some reason the tantalum somehow goes into a failure mode. And so Bob did it by opening traces. I did it by tracing along the individual wires as long as the power supply was attempting to put out current, knowing that every one of the lines on the microstrip board has got a fraction of an ohm, and if 300 or 100 milliamps is flowing through it, by going from point A to point B along that trace, you can, with a millivolt meter, measure the voltage drop and therefore confirm that the current is flowing in that direction and you're going in the right direction to get to the short circuit. That's how I found the bad one. Let's see how Eric does it. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
This is RIWK2EJ. Many a tantalum and actually many a 0.1 bypass have I replaced in my life, and finding them when you've got 100 of them, each one sitting across the chip becomes really rather difficult to find. But a bunch of years back, I took an old RF probe and emptied it, wound a little coil at the tip of it, put a little op amp in it, and a little bit of an LED and a knob, and what I made was a current sensing probe. And what you do is you set a threshold point and start moving it along the traces of the board. And eventually, either way you have it set, either the light lights up when you get an increased current where the short is occurring, or if you have it set and inverted, the light goes out. It was kind of a clumsy device, but I eventually bought the Hewlett-Packard equivalent, which is very, very nice. So a little expensive, but, you know, it's got some clips on it, took the power supply. You can use a knob on it, you can set the threshold, and it's got a nice, cute little tip that works over little tip capacitors, for all that matter. And that's a nifty way to... and you can actually begin to trace, and if you wanted to figure it out by Kirchhoff's law, but you could actually find where traces split, and you can see the difference in current. K2RIW,
as you guys are seeing, there's some very crafty techniques for troubleshooting, looking for short-circuited capacitors and short-circuiting other components. So even though the power supplies are there, I'm going to guess that the counter requires a very clean voltage, not to do a triple counting, and therefore there may be another downrange intermediate regulator, which also has a tantalum capacitor. So the true voltage is getting to the counter assembly is the next thing that I would I'd be looking for, Joe. Let's see how Mel would handle this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, we had a 8640B, and that thing wound up at Hewlett-Packard a few times. Now, which version do you have? The 001, or just what I'm going to say, may be only option that is the problem with the one we had. There was a 001, a 002, and a 003 on the 8640B. Which one do you have?
Go ahead with that one, Joe, if you happen to know.
I believe the third option is RF power protection and up to at least 1024 megahertz. That's what I have. As those two options into it.
You've got it, Mel.
All right, so what? Oh boy. Well, remember, now I got to remember which version was what. It's a long time ago. What was the trouble? There was a, let's see, do you have the one that goes from 512 to 1024 megahertz? Is that the correct number, generator? Over.
Yeah, that's what he said, Mel. His does go to 1024 megacycles. Go ahead.
Yes, it goes to 1024 megahertz. And it has the optional RF protection circuit built into the unit.
I think that was the problem. If I remember questioning him, that's what I think. It was an option that was in there, a reverse power option or something. I think that's what they told me was the problem with that when I finally spoke to the guy after they had it back here a couple of times. And for some reason, now it's going back a lot of years, I think that's what he said was the problem. If it was also, sometimes it just did strange things, and I don't remember if that was the exact strange thing, over.
So it looks like you're going to have to keep plodding along a little bit further. Since it is the counter that is not moving, it's either not getting the RF itself to count, and by way of your spectrum analyzer and other voltage probing and oscilloscopes, you'll find out, is there really RF present? If there's no RF present for some reason, obviously there's no signal for the counter. I mean, what looks like a counter failure may really be a counter that's working beautifully, but it's got nothing to count. Is the RF present at the place where the counter does its monitoring? If not, now you've got to find out, is the free-running cavity oscillator running? Are the intermediate stages running? It's going to take troubleshooting, signal tracing type troubleshooting. So, as I see it, the next thing is to confirm with that beautiful paper manual you've got. It'll tell you which test point allows you to see the presence of RF into your oscilloscope or into your service monitor operating as a spectrum analyzer. You've got the right test equipment, Joseph. It's just going to take a crafty use of it to zero in. So from what you're describing, my next question would be, is there really RF present? If so, the counter ain't counting it. Or if the RF is really getting to the counter isn't counting it. My guess is that there may not be any RF getting to the counter. Back to you, Joe. The B2RYY, K2RYW.
The RF detection unit looks like it.
Got one more comment.
Maybe I didn't explain it completely so you understand what I was talking about.
Aircom.
The digits went into overflow on the counter. I couldn't get the digits to go back the normal way to display the frequency correctly on the dial. I was operating at like about 500 meg, 510 meg, something like that. I couldn't get the thing to display the digits properly when it can go back to the normal range. I turned the power off on the unit. When I turned the power back on, the display had nothing on it. It was blank. That's the problem.
If somehow it works, Dick, I could give him an outline.
Okay. We've got both Mel and Bob in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
Remember that generator so well. See, the way that the digital counter works on this stick, it is what they call phase lock synchronizer digital frequency readout. That is the sequence of work. First it goes to phase lock, then it goes into synchronizer. So in other words, it's phase lock synchronizer, that's the sequence, then it goes to digital readout act with accordance to the frequency, Dick, over.
WHCDO with information.
Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, I own quite a few of these, and I mean, can't many. Joe, if you want to give me a call, I'll tell you what to do. Because I had the same problem as mine. Same exact problem, I'll tell you what it is. If you want to call me on the phone, I'll explain it to you. And for information, there's three options, 1, 2, and 3. Option 1 is the variable frequency audio generator. Because they had it fixed at 400 cycles or 1,000 cycles, but they also made a variable frequency module, and that's option 1. Option 2 is the frequency doubler, which brings it to 1024 megs, and option 3 is reverse power protection, as you mentioned. Dick, if Joe could give me a call, that'll be fine. I can help him.
Give us a little bit of a hint, Andy. Andy, your audio is very heavy. You might want to speak a little bit softer. When the counter completely stops counting, and you've seen it, and you finally troubleshot it, in your particular case, what was the failed component, Andy? Go ahead.
It was not a component. The frequency counter is held in place by finger stock, which makes contact to the circuit board that it needs to. And there are two screws that hold the counter in. And I found that oxidation built up on the little gold fingers that connect the counter to the board that it marries to or mates to. All I needed to do was take a pencil eraser and clean the oxidation from the contacts, reseat the counter, and it worked fine.
Okay, that sounds like a good suggestion. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, Andy, I will try that because I definitely did see the device you're talking about. It looks like a block with fingers on both sides of it that match between the counter body and the circuit board below it. I definitely did see that. You think that's the only thing that would cause this problem?
Bob recognized, but Andy first. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, it's a common problem with those units. Those contacts build up oxidation over time, and it's not only the counter. There are other contacts. I don't remember where they're all located, but you got to make sure that those contacts are making good low resistance connectivity, and there's no oxidation that's built up. And you'll notice that if you took it apart, you'll see there's contacts on both sides of the board. You got to take the whole thing apart, clean it up, and put it back together again. That's what I've noticed with the ones that I've seen where the counter failed. Dick, I'll give it back to you.
Yeah, Andy, on a quick break, you said you use a pencil eraser, which is a little bit severe and abrasive to that very thin gold plating. Is that the preferred way of cleaning gold contacts? I'd like to believe somebody makes the right kind of a solvent that can be sprayed or brushed in there. Over to you, Andy.
I've used pencil erasers with good luck. I'll back away from the mic, by the way. But there's a chemical made by Cakes, spelled, or I think it's C-A-I-G or C-H-A-I-G, something like that. Cake Laboratories makes a chemical called deoxit. It's a deoxidizing chemical that's used in contacts, rotary switches, and things of that nature. You could use that too. But I never had a problem using a pencil eraser. Of course, doing it lightly and gently. I'm not going to destroy the thickness of the gold contact. All I did is I did it lightly to eliminate some of the oxidation that built up. So, and I had good luck with mine. But you could use a deoxid, which Technitool sells that. You could buy it from them as a chemical. Go ahead, Dick.
Thank you.
Okay, very good suggestion. Wesley recognized, but Bob came first. K4 in November, Bravo Charlie. Go ahead, Bob.
All right, thanks, Vic. I just wanted to add, there's a guy in Richmond Hill, in Queens there, K6 Delta Papa Zulu, Hal Goretzky. His website is landair.com, LANDAIRCOM, landair.com. I'm sorry, landaircom.com, landaircom.com. Anyway, he's got parts and boards and everything you need for 86 40B generators and all kinds of other stuff. All you guys, I'm Dick, I know you know the guy, but if you need parts for that old test equipment, see Hal there. He can probably help you out. Back to you, Dick, from K4NBC.
Yeah, that is a good suggestion, Bob. Hal, K6 Delta Papa Zulu, is a member of this club. He has told us in the past that he owns 8640B single generators. I think he's got a couple of shelves full of them with his spare parts ready to be cannibalized or whatever. So he's a good contact where if Joe finds out that he has a failed subassembly, and he wants to replace that subassembly, Hal's the right guy. And maybe if Joe wants a speedy response and he wants just somebody else to fix it, he could go to Hal. But the Joe I know, his pride is such that he would enjoy the process of finding the error himself. I know he's going to pursue that for quite a period of time first. Wesley, I wonder if you own an 8640B, and what have you seen for troubleshooting procedures? N2XJN, K2RIW.
No, as far as I know, I don't have this one. I can check again. But since 1938 till now, the military standard in Europe, especially in Poland, Russia, Czech, Slovakia, and any other country, is an alcohol, a drinking alcohol, 97%. It is being called spirit. John will know what is the English name for it, but you just Google it, and you're going to find out. Now, where are you going to buy it? Go to the Polish liquor stores in Greenpoint or Ridgewood and talk to the people. This is a military standard. They didn't change it. They use it for now. I don't know what they use in military in the United States. Back to you, Andrew Shea.
Ethyl alcohol.
Okay, so the spirits or ethyl alcohol as a cleaning fluid. I think the deoxid is also an extremely good way of going. All righty. Good luck with that troubleshooting procedure, Joe. Check back with us as you proceed over the weeks. And let's hope that you've got enough information tonight to lead you in the right direction. Tom, Kilo Bravo 2, Hotel Zulu Echo, I think it is, yeah. Hotel Zulu Echo. Go right ahead with your question, Tom. From the Bronx, KQRIW, my name is Dick.
All right, Dick, and everyone here on the net, this is KB2870. All right, I was just curious, being that I'm running an Echolink conference server, I found out that they sell this DV dongle, you know, the one that comes with an antenna, and then you can become a D-Star gateway. What I was wondering is, if I'm running that DV dongle on one computer, and then I come in via another computer using a D-Star radio, and that D-Star radio is connected to a Rig Blaster and then connected to Echolink, the audio will pass, and is it allowable, is what I'm curious about. Maybe you might know offhand to run a D-Star system with Echolink. So in other words, I would buy the DV dongle, or have that running on one computer, which doesn't run Echolink enough, and it just makes you become a D-Star gateway, then via another radio running on the KB2870-R, let's say, using as a link radio, just like it would be a regular 2-meter or 440 rig, but in D-Star mode, would it pass the audio through, and do you think it's allowable? Caller?
I'm not going to be able to help you on this one. I know very little about D-Star. I hope somebody within the sound of our voice tonight can answer Tom's question. With reference to D-Star and the gongles and the various computers for linking up to Echolink. Does somebody have some smarts on this area? Please give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet listening. I was a little bit afraid of that one, Tom. The total number of people who have gotten the interest or actually pursued D-Star on this particular net to date is a very small number of people. So we've got rather little experience on that one. You may be blazing the trail. You and your people, Tom, may be blazing the trail on this one. There was one other guy who was pursuing D-Star. I wish I could remember his call letters right now. I wonder if someone else remembers the call letters of the guy who signed in with D-Star questions and information about 2 months ago. Do you remember who it was? Please sign in right now and tell us his call letters. K2RIW listening.
HMM.
Okay, somebody HMM or something like that. Give me slowly the full call letters and the call letters of the guy who had the D-Star information. Go right ahead, back to you, and give me your call letters and name first, sir.
Yeah, Dick, this is Charlie, WA2HMM. Jay at work is very, very knowledgeable on that. K-A-2-U-G-C. K-A-2-U-G-C is the guy he's got a contact. Tell him to look him up on QRZ. K-A-2-U-G-C. Dick, let me go back into the listening mode.
All right, Dick. K-2-R-I-W and the checkup is KD-2-8-City. Thanks a lot. No, I was just curious, maybe someone would know offhand. I mean, the theory does sound... like I said, I was just curious if that would actually work. And being that if the radio was in D-Star mode and it's connected to an interface and then connected into Echolink, if the audio would pass through with no problem. It would be digital to digital, so I don't see why not. This was just something that I came with off in my head in order to get onto D-Star and try it out. But thanks a lot, and I'll be listening to the next further, and I do appreciate your help. KB2 is sitting back to next.
Yeah, very fine, Tom. That was Charlie, WA2HMM, who gave us that information. But the man who is apparently the expert locally, who I think lives in the Patchogue, Long Island area, is Kilo Alpha 2 Uniform Golf Charlie. J. Paul White, I think is his name. But Jay apparently has quite a bit of D-Star experience. So by way of QRZ.com, you Google or find Kilo Alpha 2 Uniform Golf Charlie. If I got the call letters correct, then he has a lot of information for you. Anybody want to correct me on what I said so far?
I'm at W2CH.
Okay. We got EJ, CH, but KE2EJ was first. Go ahead, Eric.
The last letter is Zulu. The last letter is Zulu.
Okay. Kilo Alpha 2 Uniform Golf Zulu. I should know that by now. I've met him so many times. Eric, go right ahead.
Now, what I think he's asking is, he takes audio out of a D-Star radio through a rig blaster of sorts and pops it into his echo link node. Is the audio going to pass? No, it's audio. There's nothing fancy about it. I mean, after the end of D-Star, there's a D-A converter. It turns into audio. So if you're starting with audio, you want to pass it through an audio circuit into another computer, go right ahead. It's not like some of the fun encryption that we actually stick in audio today. If you like try to copy DVDs or copy protected CDs, even through the audio line, it won't. There's a little magic thing that they do that they easy to undo, but that's just not the case with these stars. Keep probably WK2J.
Very fine, Eric. Sounds like it's going to work. The guy who signed in with something CH, please give me your full call and your name, and then proceed with your information, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, K2RIW in the net. W2 Charlie Hotel. W2CH Ray in White Plains. Now, I'm on D-Star, and just thought I'd make some comments of the D-Star repeater in Brooklyn, WG2MSK on 445.475, which is a gateway. And there are a lot of knowledgeable people there, too. There is Ken in Sparta, New Jersey, who has a hotspot, N2KTO, who is regularly on that repeater and is quite active in setting up D-Star repeaters like the new one in Tuxedo Park, New York. And I'm active in some of the repeaters, including the Weka one here that's near me in White Plains, Dick.
Very fine, Ray. Hey, Tom, it looks like your group and Ray, Whiskey 2, Charlie Hotel, you guys are in each other's backyard. You've got to hook up, and you're pursuing something very similar. See if Tom wants any more fill on this information. KB2, Alpha Zulu Echo, K2RAW. Go ahead, Tom.
All right. No, thank you very much, K2CH and KA2UGZ, or Z, I think it was. I do appreciate it. Just one other thing that I'm curious about, and just, you know, see if you agree with me. In order to transmit D-Star, in other words, you have to register with the D-Star network. Now, if I'm running an Echo Link node, and I connect D-Star to my Echo Link node, in other words, my call sign will be registered, but if other stations tee up on the Echo Link side and the audio is passed, is it okay? Like, do they have D-Star reflectors? That was another thing. But thanks a lot. This is very interesting, and we'll just go with that last question. In other words, if I register, do people have to actually say they're coming through my D-Star station, or do they have to register as well as far as using it? Because if I have it connected on Echo Link, let's say like right now I have 10 stations connected to me coming in from all over the world. Now, if I have D-Star connected, let's say one of these guys that are not registered go to transmit and it goes through, is it okay? That's the only other thing.
I'm going to turn it back to Ray because I think he can answer that one for you, Tom. And by the way, Ray's call letters, you call them K2CH. It is Whiskey 2 Charlie Hotel. Ray, let's see if you got an answer for him. You got it, Ray.
Jay, Dick, and I think it was Tom out there asking this. I'm not exactly sure on the proprietary of that as far as it goes, because when you register with D-Star, you register through a gateway. I happen to do it with Norwalk through a ham I know who runs their repeater from the Greater Norwalk Club, W1NLK, which is on 441-600. When you use a program to program your rig for D-Star, like a D-Star calculator, you put in a pass to go through the gateway, and there usually you put in your call, sometimes your rig, and who you are. So that identifies you. The gateway is an internet connection that lets you go through other repeaters or paths to other gateway-connected repeaters, which can be worldwide. I've spoken with New Zealand through the one in Brooklyn. But as to that aspect of the legality of other stations coming through Echolink, I'm not exactly sure. I just think of the way D-Star works, or hotspots like Gordon W2TDT also has a hotspot, as he calls it, operates like a simplex frequency 145.420 in Bergenfield, New Jersey. That's another one in the New York area. But you might need someone else more, Tom, to clarify that part of connecting Echolink with D-Star. Back to you, Dick, W2CH.
Okay, when it comes to the legality of other people coming through the D-Star system, does anyone else on frequency have further information for Tom on this one? Give me a call letters right now. Okay, it looks like you've tapped all the information that's available to us tonight at this time, Tom. But you're allowed to come back next week and repeat your question. We'll eventually get an answer for you. And good luck with that project, Tom, and as it proceeds, because the majority of us here are kind of light on D-Star information. Whatever you discover, we'd like to hear about it, so come back and tell us about it. All right, now I'm going to go over to the space report with
Eric.
Who is that?
K2J.
Go ahead, Eric. Maybe you know.
One last comment. So according to the FCC rules, because you're operating in this country, it becomes irrelevant what happens outside of this country. There are certain kinds of communication that you don't really want to allow on any of the U.S. repeaters. And even though we have Echolink here, we have restrictions on certain countries where we don't have third-party agreements and stuff like that. So, I mean, there actually are some rules. It doesn't matter whether it's D-Star or anything. If it's being transmitted in the United States, it falls under the FCC's purview in terms of the type and the point of origin of communication. So that's just a word for the wise in terms of, you know, if you want to talk about legalities. As far as D-Star as a collective group, what they permit and don't permit, I suppose that's the individual gateway and repeater operators, as opposed to, say, IRLP, which is a little bit different kind of organization. So just that's my last 2 cents. K2RIW, K2J.
Thank you, Eric, for that additional information. So you seem to make it sound like the most dominant part of the legality of other people coming through a system is really if it happens to involve multiple countries, is there third-party agreement between the United States and those particular countries? Alrighty, we're going to go over to the space report, and Paul, you do want to see, thank goodness, Don AB2IF sent me a copy of the Wall Street Journal, August 1st, 2011 issue. There's an article called Dark Matter, Black Holes, and the First Stars. It's got a very lofty sounding title, but the article is 90% about the James Webb Space Telescope. And the main thing that I get out of the article is the fact that it is coming up to a $1.6 billion overrun, and it's running approximately $5 billion right now, and there are people estimating it's going to be a $7 billion total price tag to develop and launch James Webb. As such, the article seems to be saying that Congress is looking very strongly at the possibility of canceling James Webb. Let me drop. And so lots of scientists are going to be very unhappy about that because, as I see it, arguably the most productive piece of space hardware, either the first or the second most productive piece of space hardware, is the Hubble Space Telescope, the International Space Station or Spirit and Opportunity or Cassini or some of these other spacecraft are also very high on the list. But the Hubble Space Telescope is one of the highest on the list of most general Americans, and it's on its last leg, so to speak. In other words, there probably will never be another repair mission for the Hubble Space Telescope. And so lots of people are saying, okay, this super-duper version, which is called James Webb, they would like that to take over where Hubble leaves off. But if the total price tag for James Webb runs high as the predictions, there is the possibility Congress is going to cancel it. I mean, the superconducting super collider that we spent a lot of money starting to develop and dug the hole in Texas to build that great big particle accelerator. And after a lot of money was spent, we canceled that one. Let's hope this one doesn't get canceled. You probably got some opinions on this one, as well as the other space information you want to give us, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW and SecNet. You've got it, Paul. Wait for the beep and worry about those one-minute timings there, Paul.
Okay, fine, Dick. I'll try to do that. Very good. James Webb, I hope they don't cancel it. It sounds like it's getting higher and higher in price. But I always believe that no matter what they do with the space program, whatever they're building, there's so many, not only people directly employed from it, but there's also indirect employment that's surrounded all these projects. And, it's like anything else, you know. You build a big something somewhere, and if it's big enough, you'll have delis and movie theaters and neighborhoods and everything built around it, whatever it might be. So it's just a philosophy that I have. The space program has probably employed indirectly probably 400,000 people back in the 60s and 70s and through the 80s. As they cut back things, though, you know, that's not good. So, very good, Dick. Let me drop it. Okay. Dick, I just wanted to bring up last week's mission, the Juno flight that successfully did take off on the 5th of August. Went off almost about an hour late. They were concerned about a leak in the helium system on the Atlas rocket. It was launched by an Atlas V. And that's our heavy lift vehicle right now. They had a problem. They thought it might be internal on the Centaur rocket, the second stage. But they found out it was external. And it went off without a hitch and went into orbit, and it left Earth orbit, and it's now on the way to Jupiter. The solar wings are all opened up. It's a 4-ton thing. Each solar wing is about 34 feet or so. End to end, it's about 70 feet. So it's a big spacecraft. It has to have big solar panels because it's going out to Jupiter. Inverse square law, it comes down to about 5 times less power if you're looking at the sun with a solar panel by Jupiter than by Earth. It's WS2N. So you got Juno successfully going to Jupiter in about 5 years. It'll go into a polar orbit for 33 orbits. And each orbit would take about 11 days, so roughly a one-year mission. At the end of that, they'll crash it into the planet, and that will be the end of Juno. So
So you got that mission on the way, and you have the GRAIL mission coming up. The GRAIL is a lunar mission that's going to be launched in October. There's actually another unmanned spacecraft going up in September, WX satellite by NOAA. Actually, it's a deal between NOAA and the defense to cut back on course. Talking about course, they've taken basic weather satellites. You know, they've had military and private, and now what they're doing is cutting course and putting the two together. And during let's say a daytime orbit, you're going to have civilian NOAA controlling it, and then at the other 12 hours, you're going to have the military looking at it. So there you go. But that's next month. But then one after that is called the GRAIL, and it's one launch vehicle that's going to send this thing up. It's a Delta II rocket. That's not one of our heavy lift vehicles, but they'll be sending it to the moon. It's two satellites. It'll separate, and you'll have actually two identical satellites orbiting the moon, and they'll be spaced like a couple of hundred miles apart. And the idea that this mission is to really measure the gravity fields of the moon, and of course to take pictures as well. It's going to be at a very low orbit, around 50 kilometers. So that's a lot lower than, let's say, the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Paul, you timed out for about 1 minute, so if you can back...
James Webb, yeah. Here's the thing. Like I said, I think last week, the week before, it's about the size of an airplane, like a 737. It's a big thing. Very complex to build this thing. I saw on the internet somebody work that's involved in trying to get these gigantic shades to open up, and I could see this being a pretty big problem. I hope they get funded and do it, but it looks like a mechanical nightmare. You know, the segments on these on the telescope, the mirror is 21 feet in diameter, and I think there's 36 of them, and they fold, I think, into about, I don't know, half a dozen sections, and they have to unfold and put themselves together in orbit. And, you know, between that and the things, it's going to be on a motor to move. Each mirror has individual motors to move the mirror one way or the other to line things up correctly. It looks like a mechanical nightmare, but hopefully they can do it. I think they could. They'll give it a good shot. Dick, back to you. WS2S.
One transmission ago, Paul, you timed out for about a minute, and I was going to tell you to repeat that last minute of that transmission, but then you came back immediately with the additional James Webb information. Good stuff, though. Not to worry. Fucked up. You and I are going to have to set ourselves a timer because we do time out the machine periodically. I've got one advantage over you, that I hear what's coming back out of the machine, and I know when I've timed it out. So you're going to have to set a clock in your shack. Good information. Now, let me drop for a second.
I'm doing the same thing, but I can't hear it right, Dick.
Okay. You're doing the same thing, but you can't hear it. I'm wondering what you mean by that, Greg Paul?
I'm listening to Selvin in one ear and trying to talk through the Western input at the same time, Dick.
NY2H, and Selvin stayed up when Klonos went down. That's why Paul didn't realize it.
Oh-ho. I didn't realize that Paul is coming through Selvin. He sounded so clean, I thought he was coming... Wait a minute now. I'm hearing your transmissions on the 146.25 input. All right, so, in other words, even though 8.5 dropped out, the Selden machine kept on transmitting when you timed out 8.5.
So it has a longer timeout.
Okay, that makes sense. So I assume he is coming through 8.5 because I'm hearing on the 2.5 input, but then the repeats of Selden kept going on. Makes sense. Okay, let me drop.
Yeah, Dick, that's what I'm doing. I'm transmitting to Glen Oaks. I'm listening to Selvin.
Yeah, what I'm doing is I'm transmitting to Glen Oaks, and I'm listening on Glen Oaks. that gives me a little bit more of an advantage to know when I truly time the machine out. All right, now we're going to go over to the deeper stuff, and there's something I want to bring to Wesley and John's opinion real fast. Although I'm going to go over to John first because he's got a question. But one of the things I want to bring to his attention is that you guys definitely want to get a hold of the IEEE Spectrum magazine, the August issue 2011. The August issue on page 36 has got a beautiful article called Magnet Makeover. And what the article is basically saying in 4.5 pages is that they have discovered a technique of doubling the signal strength of the magnetic strength of a neodymium iron cobalt magnet, a neodymium iron boron magnet, NIF magnet. They have discovered a technique for doubling that magnetic field, and there's a lot of strong motivation for doing that. As you make stronger and stronger magnetic fields, you can build more efficient motors, smaller motors, better actuators. It's the current neodymium magnets that have allowed us to make these super reliable, super compact disk drives that everybody's now using. Let me drop.
I had a comment on James Webb, Dick, real quick.
Go ahead with your James Webb comment.
Okay, a few weeks ago, the New York Times had a little article called The Watchdog, the Federal Watchdog. They had an article in it, and they said with the James Webb, you know, they watch the spending of the federal government, and they said that with the James Webb project, if they took together all the people that are working on it, and the backup technicians and fires, all the people, they said they took all the people together, they said it would be the equivalent of spending, giving each one a $5 million salary over.
Wow. Okay. Let's hope James Webb doesn't get canceled. That's an ambitious piece of hardware. My goodness. Big as all heck, complicated as all hell, being launched a million miles away in order to get deployed into that particular Lagrange point beyond the Earth, a million miles further away from the Earth, in the direction opposite from the sun, and there's only one of them. So if we put $7 billion or $5 billion into that particular project, we're all going to be chewing on nails to make sure it deploys correctly. Hubble, as extremely productive as it was, started off as a $2 billion dud. In other words, at first, because of a very subtle failure of the method of manufacturing the mirror, the thing had essentially no focus. It made very huge, sensitive, blurry pictures. And if it wasn't for that Story Musgrove rescue mission that really turned those ashes into gold, if you know what I mean, if it wasn't for that rescue mission, that would have been... that thing went from rags to riches very, very nicely by way of that rescue mission. Okay, getting back to magnets, you definitely want to see this, as I said, August issue of Spectrum Magazine. The way you measure the quality factor, the maximum energy product, is something called millions of Gauss Oersteds, MGOs, mega Gauss Oersteds, I'm going to call them. And that's a combination of the high saturation magnetization plus strong coercive field. So how strong a magnet can you make, and how well can it hold its magnetic field when a reversing procedure is being applied to it? That energy density energy product is called a mega Gauss Oersteds. So they're about to double that number by way of these new production techniques. They're finding some difficulty doing it at the nano scale.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They want to take nano scale products of particles and marry them just right in order to get all of these domains properly lining up in order to double the magnetic field. Some of the people who've been doing research on this, there's a group in Russia led by Nikolay Manikov, a physicist at the Orenburg State University in Russia, and also Mr. Eckert Neller and Reinhold Hawig from the Ruhr University in Germany. So these are some of the people, and there's a bunch of American scientists and so on. So this is a big deal. These are super magnets, and we're slowly discovering an awful lot of what really goes on with radio propagation starts off magnetically, is the conclusion I'm coming to. I'm beginning to think that magnetic fields are a hell of a lot more important than electrostatic fields. And so you can build an electrostatic motor, but it's fleet-powered compared to a magnetic motor. Looks like magnetic is where it really is. And it's a property that used to be considered a real magic in the past. We only partially understand it today. So I want to bring that to you guys to your attention. And I know, John, you had a question, so let me pass it over to you. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Mel, Dick, everybody on the net. Yes, Dick, I have a question on a directional coupler. Is it possible that a directional coupler can generate spurious signals, which is a passive device?
There's a yes and a no to that. If I took a true, pure directional coupler, it is the most linear thing in the world. By linear, I mean it obeys superposition, it obeys reciprocity, it does everything just right. Oh yes, if I put megawatts of power into a directional coupler made with strip line and I start arcing it over, without a doubt I'm going to get all kinds of nonlinear effects. But there's a catch. And that is, some of the directional couplers that you guys like to buy are a directional coupler with a built-in crystal diode detector. Once you add that crystal diode detector, you now have a definite nonlinear process in there. If the crystal diode detector is on a coupled line that is coupled at minus 20 dB compared to the straight through line, and the crystal diode detector in its process of generating a harmonic, intermod, whatever, is doing it typically 10 dB weaker than the signal that gets to it, and then that signal has to be cranked back out of the 20 dB coupler, you can see that there's a procedure by which, in that particular diagram I'm describing to you right now, the amount of other frequency products it could produce are going to be a large number of dB suppressed. But other than having a nonlinear device connected to the directional coupler itself, other than that, you've got a pure directional coupler with nothing but a good dummy load on it, or even if it's one of the four-port devices where you externally supply the dummy load, it has no mechanism for making any kind of undesired frequency product, as I see it, John. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick, my problem has been, I've got a directional coupler, got the dummy load on the end of it, and I'm putting in a signal, and my spectrum analyzer is sweeping from 0 to 500 megahertz. I have a nice signal at 225 megahertz, but at 304 megahertz, I have another little pip. Very high Q, and it's my main signal is at about 10 dB, and that little blip is at 4 dB. It's not coming from the generator, and I have no idea. I've tried another generator. I even have to do a different spectrum analysis. I have no idea where that's coming from.
Did I hear you say you used a second spectrum analyzer and you measured the exact same pattern? Run that by again, John. Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct, Dick. I've also used different cables. The only thing that's common is this one, this port device. I have another one similar to it, not the same frequency range, does not exhibit this extra little pip.
You said the other device. Does that mean an other directional coupler of the same number of decibels of coupling coefficient? Run that one by again, John. Go ahead.
Yes, they're identical in coupling coefficient, different manufacturers, though. One coupler gives me this problem no matter what I do. The other coupler, with the same frequency being swept, no appearance of this signal coming out of the noise floor.
When you get a frequency component, that's not easy to explain. In other words, this other pip that you don't want to see appears not to be easily harmonically related. I think you said you're running 200 and some odd megacycles from the signal generator through the directional coupler. The spectrum analyzer is on the coupling port, either looking at forward power or reverse power, and brand A does it, brand B of directional coupler does not do it. And they both are the exact same number of dB of directional coupler. Hopefully they're both made for essentially the same frequency region. Now, one of the things you've got to worry about is that a spectrum analyzer on the very first band, the 0 to 2 gig band of That's the way your particular spectrum analyzer is designed. It is, you're looking directly into that mixer front end, and the mixer has a finite number of decibels of local oscillator to RF rejection. Yes, it's supposed to be doing up converting. It's supposed to be a bandpass filter that doesn't allow the local oscillator to come through. But a spectrum analyzer is an extremely weak sweeping signal generator. As such, your circuitry is seeing two frequencies simultaneously. However, your only sensing device is the spectrum analyzer. The only extraneous source of signal is the signal generator. And you have reason to believe by way of low-pass filtering, band-pass filtering, or whatever, that the signal generator is pure. And if I know you, you've got more than one signal generator you can put in there. What brand name of directional coupler is giving you the effect? What brand name of directional coupler is not giving you the effect? Back to you, John, K2RIW.
The Alfred is giving me good signal response. MAC, M-A-C, is the one that's giving me this extra little frequency appearance. And I've used two different generators, and I've used two different dummy loads.
Now, once again, the signal generator is set at what frequency, at what power, how many dB is the directional coupler, and how strong is this undesired signal? So give me some specific. What frequency is the sig gen set at? What frequency is the bad guy? How many dB between the two? How many dB is the coupler? Go ahead, John.
Okay, the generator of the Gigatronics Fulton set at 225, which shows on my markers right on frequency with both generators. They're both 20 dB couplers, and they span up to 1 gig. Both of the dummy loads are 50 ohms, and I like to work with the minimum signal to get a waveform I can work with. I do not try anything higher than that. I've adjusted the output of the generator to give me a 10 dB on the screen, and the noise, or whatever that signal is at 4 dB, and that's with the MAC coupler. The output doesn't show.
Okay, one or two Gigatronics. Boy, you are well equipped if you've got a pair of Gigatronics SIG generators. That in itself is a potent machine. Set at 225 megacycles, 50 ohm load on the directional coupler straight through port. The minus 20 dB directional coupler, good to 1 gig. You said that the main signal at 225 is 10 dB on screen. What power level in dBm is the Gigatronic set for, or what do you believe it's producing? And the undesired signal, well, first of all, the signal generator is set at what power level? I'm going to assume that you're looking in the forward mode of the directional coupler. In other words, you're measuring what's coming out of the signal generator as opposed to what's coming back from the dummy load. So it's the forward mode of the directional coupler. If the signal generator was set at 0 dBm, a 20 dB coupler would give you a signal into the spectrum analyzer of minus 20 dBm. So try to give me power level of SIG gen and your best assessment of power level of the undesired signal and what was the frequency of the undesired signal. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick. I adjusted the output of the generator. I don't know the number to get a 10 dB waveform on the spectrum analyzer with both generators. So I have a 10 dB signal at 225 megahertz. At 304 megahertz, approximately 304, I have a 4 dB signal, well out of the noise floor.
Okay, when you say there's a 10 dB signal on the spectrum analyzer, does that mean 10 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio? The signal is 10 dB above the noise. And in order for that to have any meaning, you've got to tell me how was the spectrum analyzer set. Were you using a 1 KC filter or a 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth filter? So how was the spectrum analyzer set as far as res bandwidth of the filter is concerned? And when you say 10 dB, do you mean 10 dBm? I think not. I think you're telling me it's 10 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio on the screen, is what I think you're saying. Back to you, John, for a correction on that.
That's correct, Dick. It's 10 dB above the noise. So now, with the 10 dB signal there and the 4 dB above the noise, I, again, I can't fathom where this 4dB is coming from, and it's only from this one particular coupler. If I leave everything set exactly the same, and just tie in the other coupler,